It's episode 106 of Breaking Trail, and we're talking about using art to change the world.
How can I put myself in a position to help more than just the people who are around me, outside of me arguing with a police officer, outside of me holding a sign up in front of a police officer's face, doing something that could potentially put me in harm's way, you know, temporarily or permanently? How can I do something that's going to affect change without affecting my livelihood or my life? And what I've learned over the years is that art is the one thing that suppresses ignorance.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Breaking Trail Podcast, bi-weekly conversations with outdoor active professionals and athletes who are redefining success and living life on their own terms. We are Breaking Trail. I'm Lisa Gerber, and I help purpose-driven individuals make their idea of change happen through more effective storytelling. If you are new, welcome. Hope you stick around. You can find me on Instagram or LinkedIn at Lisa Gerber. You can email me, lisa@breakingtrailpod.com. Love to hear from you with your questions, guest suggestions, and feedback, so keep them coming. Raheem Robinson is today's guest. He's a creative director, producer, and a climber, born and based in New York City. Spending more than a decade in fashion marketing and branding, as well as outdoor brand consulting, he is now using his diverse expertise and knowledge to push the outdoor industry to create safe spaces for Black and Brown youth in underserved communities in New York. We talked about storytelling, creativity, and diversity and inclusion in the outdoors, among a number of things. I just wonder, can you think of a time where you've tried something new and felt like you had no business being there, doing and trying and working at your thing? It's intimidating. The environment feels unwelcome. And some of us, I'm sure, have experienced it here and there, but this is a place that many grow up in. And Raheem didn't let that feeling stop him from doing the things that he loves. And now he's doing work to pay that forward with his work with younger adults and through his filmmaking. So we talked about things like changing the story you tell yourself and the downside of comparison. We all know how bad that can be. And learning how to bring yourself into everything you do. He also shared how he fuels his own creativity and motivation. So with that, let's listen in and gear up for what's next. We dive in immediately in our conversation where Raheem remarks about the transition from working for so long behind the scenes and now finding himself in the spotlight with doing these podcasts and interviews and what that's like. So here he is talking about that.
My background has kept me behind the camera a lot over the years while working in fashion, you know, marketing and branding. And honestly, starting out in product placement and creative services. And so now that I've been spending a great deal of time in front of the camera, as well as being a creative behind the camera, it's just been a lot to take in. So it's interesting to hear people's perspectives on my writing, stuff that I'm featured in, people's perspective of me, and even just how I sit in the industry. Because for me, for a long time, this industry was not my industry. You know, it was just an industry that I played in. It kind of came about, and I know you haven't asked the question yet, and I'm kind of jumping in, but it kind of came about for me a great deal of time ago, because I spent, while I was in fashion, I was always in fitness, aka I was always in the gym. So transitioning into something that was a bit different wasn't hard for me mentally, but physically and externally it was a lot, you know, because the climbing culture, the outdoor mm-hmm. industry is just a very different beast. But I think just for me, that transition was a bit seamless only because I came from BMX racing as a teenager. Prior to that, I was playing ice hockey and roller hockey. So in terms of the extreme sports, going from playing hockey to, you know, an individualized sport like BMX racing, when it was, you know, one man sport, you are as good as you were yesterday and as good as you were last weekend during a race. It was easy for me to jump into the climbing world. But at the same time, the culture the community is so tight knit and small and very specific, and it has this niche to it that it does, and it did make it very hard for me for some time to feel like this is something I can actually be a part of, right? This is something I can see myself doing in a couple of years for fun, for sport, you know, to build community, or even maybe to take my career in this direction. But it just, it for a very long time, it didn't feel realistic at all. Did not feel realistic.
Well, I have a few follow-up questions to that. And I want to start by saying that I appreciate your saying that about not realizing the value in your own story. I mean, just myself working in storytelling and coaching and training clients on that very thing, I find that we have to get that outside perspective like you're getting now. You know, you're doing all of these interviews and getting out there and seeing other people kind of reflect that story back to you. It's kind of interesting. I think we become so immersed in the work that we do. It's just, that's what it is. It's normal to us. So how is that interesting to other people?
Right. And that's exactly my point. Like it's strange. And I have a 15-year-old daughter, and like her perspective matters a lot to me because, I mean, she is me just in a female form and she's 15, but like her perspective matters a lot. So it's kind of interesting to hear people from the outside speak of me and the things that I've been doing over the last couple of years, and then to hear or share my perspective or other people's perspectives on me, and for her to agree and be like, yeah, Dad, that was cool. Or yeah, Dad, that makes totally sense for you to do. Like, I can see that. For me, it's just like, all right, if you're saying this, you spend a lot of time with me, you know me best. Yeah. So if you're saying this, I must take this to heart. I have to believe that there is a gift in what I'm doing, and I have to appreciate that and accept it and show gratitude, because it's not something I didn't choose to sit where I sit now. It's kind of just how things organically just happen in the most seamless way possible. And I think for me, what really made it super realistic was when I started to notice / hear back from individuals about how my experiences affected their lives in a positive way. One specifically, which I did not mention in the questionnaire, but I do a bit of social justice work with the Brooklyn DA's office currently. And just working with those young men who are troubled teens and in their early 20s who are tied into the system, unfortunately, their perspective is very, you know, narrow-minded and very one-sided, right? They see things one way. They're used to, you know, systematically doing everything from point A to Z. Everything is a process. And, you know, step A has to do with B, C, and they have to be aligned. And if they're not, you could get into some trouble. So, you know, being able to have conversations with those guys and, you know, just be 100% real with them, you know, in terms of sharing my journey and what my processes have been like, has been eye-opening for me, because I think that's the one thing that was missing for me, you know, as I was coming up in, you know, the fashion industry and just working in fitness, whereas there wasn't anybody in the outdoor industry that looked like me or that came from, you know, a project in New York City or Harlem, you know? And so that's my foundation, that's me. So for me to not see those things, it really took me to have like a super strong, narrow-minded drive to be like, you know what, it doesn't matter. I see cars, I see trucks, I see bright lights, but I see a path. I see a way for me to go forward, and I'm gonna push forward and propel as fast and as far as I can until I physically can't anymore. So to talk to these younger guys and have them, just as an example, come back and tell me stories about how they potentially save their life and someone else's life by not making a wrong decision per se based on things I've said to them, you know, is insane to me. You know, it blows my mind to think that like this young man could have potentially lost his life for someone dear to him had he not spoken to me a week or two prior and heard me ramble and ramble as I do on and on about different things. He wouldn't have had that different perspective. He wouldn't have been thinking, okay, cool, it's not just my life I have to worry about. There's a lot of young guys and girls who live in my neighborhood that look up to me. They watch every single move I make, and based on how I operate, it's how they're going to determine how they should operate in the future. And these decisions that I'm making, I didn't realize were going to affect them the way they would. I'm just more so, I've always been thinking about me in this moment. How can I fix this problem now versus thinking strategically as to what can I do to avoid this problem being a continuance going into tomorrow, going into next week, going into next month. So for him to come back to me and say, I made a decision based off of things you said to me, and I think I literally saved my life in multiple people's lives based on words, that blows my mind. So the fact that I'm able to do that without trying brings me tons of joy and, mm-hmm. and forces me into a comfortable place where I continue to push forward and make sure that, like, I will be the voice of reason when I can. You know, I will be the voice of reason when needed. I will stand up and speak for those who can't speak as loud as I can, you know, or can't, you know, break into spaces that I'm already technically in to get a new perspective on life, you know, whether it's breaking into climbing, whether it's breaking into camping, or even just learning the outdoors. Like, if I can do that for a young man or woman and give them that guidance that they wouldn't get anywhere else, like, I'm all for it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm all for it.
So talk to me first about how you even got into BMX and ice hockey, because really this is, it's kind of a one thing led to another, and you grew up in Harlem. How, like, are you even surrounded by that? How do you get exposed to that, get into it, and stay with it?
Yeah, my grandfather, he was lack of better words, a beast. He was older, but was so in tune to everything that was going on. And in the weirdest way, like, growing up, I didn't believe it, but he was literally my best friend without me knowing it. And what I mean by that is he was the nucleus to everything that I did or everything I wanted to do. You know, he figured out a way, whether it was buying me thousands of dollars worth of, you know, hockey equipment just for tryouts, you know, or allowing me to build a bike from scratch, you know, from ordering online with his credit card for multiple magazines. He made it happen. For me, I think it was just more so me. I knew, like, the traditional sports that were, you know, done in my neighborhood, from basketball tournaments to soccer and things of that nature. Just they didn't fuel me. They didn't give me what I needed. I needed more. I needed something to, like, push me not over the edge, but close enough to the edge to where I could see below and know, you know, what the precautions I needed to take were and what the restrictions were and how I could, you know, play in that space, but get my adrenaline up and have fun at the same time. And I got that with hockey. You know, and progressing from that, I got that with BMX. You know, it allowed me to, which is something I did religiously, riding my bike throughout neighborhoods in Harlem or in Manhattan rather. But it got me onto a track, and it helped me to turn my drive for flying up and down the street, you know, into a not a career, but a passion, a hobby, you know, as a young man. And it kept me there for, I mean, I raced for maybe 3 years consistently every single weekend, every Sunday. And I couldn't have done that without my grandfather. He physically drove me and a ton of my friends, you know, with our BMX bikes stuffed in the back of his Cadillac, sticking out on the New Jersey Turnpike to New Jersey every Sunday at like 6 a.m. I'm sure he was insanely tired and tired of us, but every Sunday he took us there, he fed us, he drove us back, he fed us, he dropped everyone off, like, he did it all. So yeah, without him, I wouldn't have had that access.
Now, you were doing that with your friends. You mentioned that you felt different, and I mean, you were different, but you didn't abandon doing something where you kind of felt alone and different and unwelcome. Am I jumping ahead? Is this not in the BMX and ice hockey, or was this later in climbing and your outdoor endeavors?
It definitely happened in hockey as well as BMX. But I think I didn't really recognize it until I became an adult. Yeah. And I got into climbing. And I think for me, just as a kid, you know, you're fearless. You're not thinking about health insurance. You're not thinking about, you know, the consequences of tomorrow. You're just going. So I think the drive in those sports as a kid kept me going and kind of kept blinders on the sides of my head and allowed me to just keep propelling forward without thinking about the fact that, you know, when I would get to Secaucus, New Jersey, I was one of like two or three black kids out of 100 racers. I didn't think of things like that, you know, until a decade or so later when I would look at photos and say, oh, that was true. Cool. It doesn't make me any difference. Like, I get it. But I wasn't thinking of those things. And that didn't happen until I became older, or became an adult rather, and became more conscious to my surroundings and all the things that were happening in the world around me and outside of me.
I see. Okay. Then later you got into, I might be jumping ahead too quickly, but I'm really interested in the story about getting into climbing.
Okay.
And the story about your daughter.
Yes.
So how did that all happen?
So one, it's kind of funny and ironic and beautiful at the same time. It was a Father's Day weekend about 7 years ago, and some friends of ours were at an outdoor festival in Central Park, which is something we had never attended before we were on our way home. I think we were from coming from Brooklyn, going to Harlem. So we said, yeah, we'll stop in Central Park for a few and say, hey, you know, grab some small bites and, you know, head home. And we got there and there was an obstacle course that was sponsored by Adidas and Brooklyn Boulders at the time. And her being her, she wanted to compete in it, but didn't know that there was a prize at the end of a 1-year membership to the gym. So she competed in it and winded up getting best time for girls. She then pushed me to compete for in the men's category, and I got best time for men's. And we spent the day there in the rain competing against, actually it was a one daddy-daughter duo that we went up against for a little bit, but tons of people went against our best time, and we would have to go back again on top of their time to beat their time. And at the end of the day, we both wind up taking home first place for the girls category and the men's category. And that's how we started climbing.
I mean, I love that story. And I wanted to bring it up on the heels of the ice hockey and your grandfather's influence, because I think that was cool as a dad. A lot of dads would be like, no, I'm not going to do that. You know,
yeah.
I'll sit here and watch you. But you didn't. You went for it. Yeah. You're like, I'm jumping into this full on.
Yeah, I felt like I had to. I mean, I think too, for me, one of the main things in that moment that I remember vividly was seeing her be so motivated and so just ready to go. I saw me and I said that's yeah. me. That was me at 10 or 8 or 9, however old she was at the time. That was me during that time. And the fact that I still have a little bit of that in me, and that's her wholeheartedly, I cannot not do this. Like, I would be letting my younger self down and my future mm-hmm. self down if I don't do this now.
Yeah. I guess that's where what I was trying to ask earlier is how you find that drive and motivation at such a young age. And maybe it's the same answer. It's the influence for you of your grandfather, and for her, the influence of her dad.
Yeah.
But I think that a lot of kids, and now you're working with a lot of young adults, and, you know, they just aren't exposed to that. And so they just take a very different path with very different outcomes.
Yeah, I think it's so for me, I feel like there's two different types of people overall, right? There's those who can get motivated no matter the circumstances because they know what they need, they know what they're after. And then there are those who need that motivation. And I think that gratefully, and I am grateful to have been as a child, and I still think I am as an adult, to have that drive and that push and that motivation to just go. But also at the same time, have the influence of people like my grandfather to solidify the craziness I wanted to get into as a kid, whether it was, you know, jumping over things that were way too high on my bike and, you know, getting me on the track, or like playing ice hockey. Like, he made sure that regardless of what it was, he was able to bring me down from my high horse and wanting to do everything and anything, and kind of help me navigate what made the most sense. And that's kind of how it started with hockey, because I was rollerblading freestyle prior to it. And I know I wanted to continue to do that, and I got into street hockey, but I just didn't know what that meant. You know, no one was playing roller hockey where I was at, and there were no ice rinks too close to me. There was one on 110th where I played, Lasker Rink, but that wasn't super close, and I didn't know anyone who played there. So it's kind of like a shot in the dark, but he helped me to kind of navigate that and figure out how to make these, I guess, dreams. You know, I didn't look at them as dreams as a kid, but helped me to navigate these dreams and make them reality.
See, it's funny. We don't know the story when we're in it. It's when you look back on it yeah. and kind of tell the story. So fast forward, you're full on into climbing, and you feel alone in the world of climbing. In fact, in the information, you know, when we talked before this, you said you felt alone in an industry that you adore. So I'm curious to know can you describe what that's like, what it feels like? And again, what kept you from just abandoning it?
Yeah.
Because I feel like a majority, you know, it's almost the same question, but a lot of people would just feel like, this isn't the place for me, so I'm out.
Yeah. I think I'll give you an example of kind of how my brain works. So when I got into climbing, my theory in terms of how that process would go was kind of like what it was like for someone walking into a yoga studio and saying, oh, this is that yoga stuff. I'm interested in yoga, never done it. What do I do? How do I get started? And they would probably greet you with open arms, give you a hug, show you the yoga, you know, outfits that you could potentially purchase. yoga mats, talk you through those, talk you through the beginner teachers classes, maybe even bring a beginner teacher out to talk to you, to kind of take you through the ropes and make you feel comfortable, invite you to a free class. That's not the vibe when you walk into a climbing gym. It is the total opposite. You know, it's almost the idea of like walking into a high-end clothing store where no one, you know, wants to greet you or talk to you unless they know for a fact you're spending millions of dollars, you know? And so walking into the gym the first few times, the idea of what it was to me was beautiful. It was like, I can climb stuff. I can continue to be active. This is something new for me to conquer. I want to do this now. But in terms of what I saw in the gym, it's, you know, it's, I don't know if you climb much, but it's, or do you climb? I'll ask. Okay.
I don't climb. No.
Got it. So like walking into a gym where you have like this one side where the music is blasting, you've got a bunch of dudes who are shirtless and they're yelling and screaming every time they fall off the wall. That's intimidating. That's super intimidating for someone who's wearing rental shoes, who's never been in here, who is super overwhelmed by the colors on the walls and the shapes of the holds and what they do, the ropes versus bouldering, who's advanced, who's intermediate, who's a beginner. I don't know what's going on. So that's super overwhelming for someone. But for me, although I spent maybe the first 4 to 6 months walking out of the gym with my elbows completely shot from climbing the wrong way and not really having much technique, but there was just something about the sport that just got my body going, and it kind of felt super familiar. It felt super familiar. It felt like when I BMX raced or when I would play hockey, it gave me that same thrill. It was, I don't consider myself a thrill seeker, but it gave me that same internal fire that I got when I played those sports. Mm-hmm. And I knew for a fact that it was something that I had to keep doing, you know, even if it was just once a week or once a month. I knew this had to be incorporated into my fitness regimen somehow, some way. I just didn't know how I was going to do that, but I knew it had to be a part of it.
Yeah.
Did I answer your question?
I think anyone, yeah, you totally did. Okay. I was just thinking how it's very relatable, even though I don't climb. I mean, it's relatable. I tried surfing and you go out there on the waves and it's, you get these people out, you know. I think that feeling of being intimidated in a situation that is new to you, but I think that it's helpful for everyone to hear that and to hear it from your perspective, because that just comes back to this idea of seeing, being more aware and seeing and being more welcoming.
Yeah.
Because that's what, I mean, you're working to change that right now. And want to get back to that in a second, but for in terms of what you do for work, you're a creative director. Can you talk a little bit, talk about what a creative director does, and then we're going to merge these two paths together because this is pretty cool.
Cool. So in terms of my creative direction, it's kind of cool. So working with small fashion brands like Public School, and during my early days when I was just focusing on marketing and branding at like Sean John, I was able to transition out of working for a big brand to consulting for small brands. And that was creative direction, whether it be creative directing photo shoots for their small campaigns or for social. Then it was the storytelling aspect and just coming up with ways in which these brands could, you know, tailor to a market that didn't exist, which for a long time was a hybrid between high-end fashion and streetwear. There was that sweet spot in the middle that a few brands were able to tackle onto, but really didn't know what to do in terms of, well, who was that consumer? Well, how do we compete with, you know, the Supremes and the Nikes and the Champions and all these brands that we all know and we love and we've known since we were children, and now the kids that came after us and the next generations, they're tagged on too. How do we jump into that and be able to tackle that? And I think just through my network and my understanding of the landscape and then just being in fashion for so long made it easy for me to be able to navigate and understand, okay, cool. Aesthetically, how would this person dress? What would this person look like? Yeah. You know, are they from Brooklyn or is it Manhattan? Is it the West Coast? You know, are they a smoker? Are they a drinker? Like, what is the brand ethos behind who this person is? How do we decipher or reverse engineer what this consumer looks like in order to be able to create the perfect picture to not only make consumers want to make purchases, but make them comfortable with the images that they're seeing, right? Because for the majority across the board, whether it's fashion, entertainment, the outdoors, a majority of what you see are professional models, professional athletes, you know, big jumpers. So just as a general consumer, you see that and it's aspirational, but sometimes for the most part, it could be intimidating, right? And that's a bad job that a lot of brands have done for a long time, whereas they give you these aspirational images with these people you aspire to be like. But in your realistic mind, you know for a fact that you're never going to be James Bond. So you seeing James Bond in a $7,000 suit is not going to force you to want to buy a $7,000 suit. You may buy the one for $40 that looks just like it. you know, so you can kind of play that part, but you're never going to really buy into this idea that you need that. And I think that's always been the missing component for a lot of brands. So that's a lot of what I've been doing. But fast forward, moving into the outdoor space and kind of how I started working with OR as talent primarily, just conversating with them and trying to figure out how we can put our creative brains together. We came up with the idea that we need, or they need, better storytelling. So I've come in on the storytelling side to help as a creative partner in interviewing the athletes, you know, on every shoot, whether it's ski and snow or urban or climbing, et cetera, just really getting in touch with them as human beings and not as athletes is what I've been spending a great deal of time doing. And the main reason for that is kind of going back to what I was saying, you know, you see, as an example, Quinn Mason, who's an amazing 17-year-old climber from Seattle. You see her in the images, and most people know Quinn from social media, from being, you know, an Olympic athlete. And they see that, and it's like, okay, cool, that's amazing, but I'm never going to be that. I'm never going to be 17 again. I'm never going to be on the Olympic team, et cetera, et cetera. And that's a bit disheartening, you know, for a consumer to see that and feel that drawback. And that's when for the brand, that's not their intent. Their intent is to do the complete opposite. So now when you have someone like Quinn, who we have, you know, 5 to 10 minutes of dialogue from her about why she started climbing, how her parents got her into climbing, why she climbs, what her goals are. You know, she's 17 and she's already coaching other young girls to climb. And just being able to find out what her micro story is behind what the macro story is in terms of like the outdoor research athletic program is amazing. It's huge, because now people are able to dive in a bit deeper as to who she is as a person and not just as a climber or pro athlete. There's more. I can keep going if you want me to, but.
Well, I'm just.
Your wheels are turning.
My wheels are turning because there's so much, but it's just so amazing how you've been able to dovetail your own life experiences into this work that, you know, I mean, that's what we all do. And I talk to people all the time who are trying to find their path. They're like, I don't know what my life plan is. And it's not like you set out with a life plan to, this is what I'm going to do, you know, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. It's kind of just like from taking a step, each your next step, each step of the way. And I know you work with a lot of young adults. You said you did. And I don't know where I'm going. What do you advise the people when they're lost in their way?
It's funny. So I get asked questions like that pretty often. And it's funny because when I answer these questions, 9 times out of 10, I'm talking to myself. And what I mean by that is I feel like I constantly need a reminder. And in terms of what I would advise anyone on who's trying to find their way is, you know, don't try to find it. Don't force it. You know, go with what makes the most sense. You know, get away from this idea that there is this end goal, because trust, when you get to, whether it's a dollar amount, a title, you know, a home, it doesn't matter. Whatever that goal is, it's not to say not to have goals, but just to say be realistic, because the process of you getting there is worth so much more than that end result, that end point when you get there. And I think we need to kind of reshift our perspectives and our thinking in terms of understanding and appreciating the process, because there's a possibility you may never get to that goal. But if you were focused, hyper-focused rather, on like each individual pivotal moment in your process, and you don't get there, you'll one, understand why a lot better, and two, understand that that goal that you had may not have been realistic or what you even wanted at the end of the day. And you might have found your way throughout your process by just hyper-focusing on those steps that you're taking to get to where you at least think you want to be. And I think that is the hardest part, because, you know, just like talking to those young guys all the time, you know, they have really, really big aspirations, which are great, but it's like to just think, hypothetically speaking, oh, I want to be a business owner. It's like that is so broad and so vague, and you don't even know what you're asking for. That is a lot to ask for. Right. And it's unfortunate that like a lot of that comes from what they see on TV, what they hear and watch in media. And you know, you get this understanding that, okay, cool, because it looks cool, or because that person looks like what I want to look like, I need to do that. And it's just like, had I spent my life that way, I wouldn't be sitting here today. And it's not to say that, you know, I am an example of how to do it, but I feel like my path has kind of mapped out and dug through, not with a shovel, but with my boots, as literally I'm just walking through it so organically that like every single moment of my process, I appreciate so much. Because for me, it's like sitting here right now in this very moment, I am content with if this is where my career has taken me and this is as far as it's going to take me, I am super happy and ecstatic with where I am in this moment. Do I think there's more to come? Absolutely. Am I stressing it? Absolutely not. I'm not even thinking about it.
Yeah.
I'm enjoying this process and understanding that this step in this process and this step that I'm at and I'm in right now means so much to me in this moment. And without that and being, and I'm using my hands a lot to hyper focusing on this moment, tomorrow won't make sense and next week won't make sense either.
So many people need to hear that message, including me. I mean, so many. It's so important. And you said, you know, climbing for you has been this outlet that has helped you drive all these other things. But obviously, it's not climbing for everybody. Everybody has whatever that outlet is. You know, for me, skiing, trail running keeps me sane, keeps us focused. And so the key, like you said, is not to follow your path, but for everyone to uncover and figure out what theirs is and stay focused on that.
Yeah, and the one thing I'll leave you with regards to that is, and this is something that I tell the guys often, what you have to really force yourself to do, the one thing I believe you do, is to force yourself to become comfortable with being uncomfortable. That is the only way that change is going to take place. It's the only way that you're going to be able to uncover if what you're doing in that moment in your process makes sense for you. But if you just sit around and kind of just let it happen, without really pushing the envelope and seeing what this process means in this moment or what this moment means in this process, it probably won't make sense to you. So just get comfortable with being uncomfortable. That's life. That's when change happens. Mm-hmm. That's when the magic happens.
So you said that you regret not recognizing your creativity sooner, not realizing that you had that. And you hear that so often, people say, you know, I'm not a creative person. I mean, what is that? How did you not see it? How did you know that, oh, hey, actually, I do have this amazing skill?
Yeah, so for me, for too long, I spent a great deal of time watching other people's clocks. What I mean by that is my peers, bosses I've had in the past, senior level people at the company I worked at, and just kind of like mapping out what their process was. John Smith is 32 years old. I'll be that in 4 years. He's made director level at 31. I need to do it by 30. And I was constantly doing that. I was constantly kind of, you know, mapping my process around someone else's success, knowing that theirs had nothing to do with mine. Different times, different people, so many different variables, not one similar variable besides that we shared, you know, the person who signed his check or her check signed my check. Outside of that, there was nothing else in common, but I was constantly forcing myself to map out a game plan based on what I saw happening with others. And I don't know, it came from me just realizing that, you know what, like I have to learn how to live more timeless and not focus on what happened or what should have happened and what may happen and what will happen, and really just focus on what's actually happening right now.
Yeah. I mean, that's the theme, right? Just stressing about the future isn't really very productive. Let's talk about some of your projects and the work that you are doing with young adults. I just watched the film that was in the Banff. I didn't even write the name down. What's the name?
Oh yeah, it was at Climb Your Dreams. It was at Banff, Vancouver International Mountain Film Festival, and one or two other festivals as a finalist. And it's actually on the Banff World Tour right now.
Okay, so we're going to link that up in the show notes because it's short, it's totally worth watching, and the whole story behind it was that wasn't the intent for it. That wasn't why you created that.
Yeah, no. It wasn't. Myself and a friend of mine, Josh Greenwood and Ben Gers, went into this project as a project. It was just going to be something that we were going to use as a pitch video to pitch potential clients, you know, the Nikes and the climbing gyms and Adidas and just a bunch of different brands. And that's why you'll notice some brand hits in the film. But once it was fully edited and rendered, you know, we got the vibe, or Ben rather got the vibe, that this could potentially be a film that we could, you know, pitch to festivals. And we didn't think much of it, but they started pitching it and people started biting. And I think for us, it obviously came before, this is 2019, so it was before the madness of 2020. But I don't want to say the timing was right, but I think to a degree it was, because there were so many people during that time who, like myself, had very similar experiences not just in the climbing space, but in the outdoor industry, whereas, you know, in their respective town or city that they're from or they live or they climb in, they're the only one. They're one of, you know, very few. They've been told by their peers that Black people don't climb. Their family members are wondering, why are you outside climbing rocks? Like, that doesn't make sense. We don't do that. And that was a constant thing that I would hear personally. So for us to put out that film and to get the overwhelming amount of responses that we got from people all over the country, who, I mean, there were a few guys who hit me from South Africa, you know, saying they saw the film and how it was so touching and like climbing is so amazing down there. And I didn't know that. I knew it existed, but I didn't know that people down there were even thinking about things like this. So for them to see a film about a, you know, a creative from Brooklyn who daydreams about getting outside, and, you know, it wasn't a film where I'm a guy living in my van, you know, and, right, you know, it wasn't about van life and all the stereotypical things that you see when it comes to the outdoor space. And I mean that in the most respectful way, but it's literally what you see. You know, a brand wants to do something big and make a mark in the outdoor industry. They get a van, they go to the woods, they get some firewood. It's all the props you need, and you got you a campaign, right? So for us to do it that way, where we're shooting on the train and I was dressed the way I always dressed, and you hear the sounds of the city and the cars and all those elements that you don't necessarily hear when you watch something that has to do with the outdoors, we didn't fear that it wouldn't resonate, but we knew that we were doing something different that a lot of people could potentially not really understand. And the fact that we got the complete opposite in terms of a response was amazing.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're a half hour into it, and I feel like my questions have not done the topic justice enough. So I just want to ask you what I should be asking when you're doing all this work with, you know, around inclusion in the outdoors. And let's talk about some of these programs and more about how you're channeling all your personal experience so that the next generation don't have that same feeling, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's the feeling, and then also more so the experience, and kind of just piggybacking off of what you just wrapped into one in terms of my experience. My most recent project, which we just concluded, technically we're not done, we're still editing, but I wrote and directed a short film called The Elephant Gown, and it's focused on mental health. And that kind of came from dreams I had as a kid, experiences I had as a kid growing up, but then also my work with the young men through the Brooklyn DA's office and really figuring out. And then that in conjunction with all the protesting and all the craziness that was going on for the last, you know, 16 months, and just trying to figure out how can I put myself in a position to help more than just the people who are around me, outside of me arguing with a police officer, outside of me holding a sign up in front of a police officer's face, doing something that could potentially put me in harm's way, you know, temporarily or permanently. How can I do something that's going to affect change without affecting my livelihood or my life? And what I've learned over the years is that art is the one thing that suppresses ignorance. And it put me in a place to where I felt like what I had been writing is something that we could put out, and even if we only reach 10 people, maybe it would resonate and they would understand it, because there's always two sides to it, right? There's regardless to what you're talking about, there's people who just don't understand, and it's, you can look at it as ignorance, and then there's people who don't realize it because they're kind of what you said, they're living in it, they're experiencing it, so you don't recognize your life because you're living that life. And with this film, I feel like we were able to tackle both sides, you know, those who are ignorant or just don't know because you don't know what you don't know, to the, you know, the Black experience as a young Black man growing up in America, will be able to see this and understand it without it being something that's in your face. It's aggressive. It's, you know, making you feel uncomfortable. It's none of those things. It's beautiful art, you know, and for those who this will resonate with and they will see themselves in this young man will say, I never thought of it this way. I didn't realize that these were the traumas that I've been facing. I didn't realize that that was a trauma. I just thought it was something that we naturally dealt with. You know, give you a prime example, you know, something as simple as, you know, seeing a police sirens while you're driving. It could be four cars behind you, but, you know, for the most part, I can account for every one of my friends that I've asked this to, but like their heart jumps, or you second guess anything that you're doing, or if there's something in the car that could potentially be used or looked at as, you know, a weapon or illegal, and it's just like, we didn't do anything wrong. Why is it that we automatically jump into this mentality of, okay, two hands on the wheel, roll your window down, turn the music down. It's just like, you're not doing anything wrong. But the fact that that happens is trauma. And we don't recognize that. I didn't recognize that until I became an adult. I just realized, I just thought it was something that we just did. You just do it. But I didn't realize there was a reason as to why I did that. There was a reason as to why my grandparents would tell me things to keep me out of harm's way without blatantly telling me, do not do this because these are the consequences. It was more of stay away from trouble. You know, be careful with who you consider your friends. You know, call me if you need anything. Be nice to anyone. Be nice to everyone. If you feel like you're in harm's way, call. And to me, it was just like, they're just being overprotective. They just want to know what I'm doing with my friends. We're just playing video games at Kevin's house. Like, why are you guys on my back? Leave me alone. But in their mind, they know that going from their apartment to Kevin's house is a bit of a journey and anything can happen from point A to point B. But I didn't realize that. So that's essentially what this film is about. TJ, who is an amazing actor, he's 11 years old. I can confidently say, I don't think this kid is a kid. He is a grown individual living in a childlike body. He embodies this part as the hero so well, and in a way that I feel like a lot of people, if not everyone's perspective, that's everyone who sees this, their perspective is going to completely change as to the way they view young Black men in America, based on the story, obviously, but more so based on how he portrayed this part. It's amazing because I feel like the one thing that kept me from being my true self, and also kind of piggybacking off your two questions ago, in terms of like me allowing myself to be creative, or, you know, figuring out how to allow my creativity to come out and respect it. It comes from my mental health. It comes from, you know, being a child and, you know, being told, why are you crying? Boys don't cry. You know, go to your room, stop crying, stop asking questions, stay in a child's place. So, you know, you put this barrier around a young person's head that makes them feel like they can't do anything, they can't ask questions, they can't be themselves. So you grow up in a way, or I did, where it wasn't like a fighter's mentality, because I wasn't fighting, but it was more so this guarded mentality of like, I'm not going to show you my true self. I'm not going to cry around because I don't cry. I'm not going to express how I'm feeling because I'm not supposed to do that. And I think that that's what kept me stifled so low when it came to me wanting to create earlier on. And I want to say over the last 15, 20 years, and I feel like I've definitely been super as creative as I can be over the last maybe 5 to 8 years. But there was a lot of years where, you know, I would be in meetings. I'd, you know, be meeting with different companies, and I would give them my creativity, but it was so surface. You know, it was so surface, and it was what I thought they wanted to hear. It was what I thought they wanted to see. It was what I thought they wanted to read, versus me giving them Raheem, versus me giving them my perspective. I was giving them a perspective, you know, and it was always safe. And that was just because that was my upbringing. And I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that mental health wasn't something we talked about in my family. You know, for a lot of my friends, therapists, I've heard it a million times, Black people don't go to therapists. Therapists for what? Talk to your friends. You know, tell me what's wrong. You know, that was their response. So the idea of talking to someone and expressing how you truly felt, whether it was to a therapist, you know, or to a potential client, just always felt wrong. And I think I had to come into myself and realize that, you know what? There is no wrong in this. I can create and I can be, you know, my true self and be okay with that, because no one's going to be comfortable with who I am until I'm comfortable with who I am. And I think when that happened is when it all happened, because you can see that in someone, you can see someone in their true self. And you think of people, I'm not comparing myself at all, but to Jean-Michel Basquiat, like, you know, some people looked at him as insane. He was crazy. He would walk the streets of New York and in Brooklyn, you know, and ripped up clothes and would give roses to random women and would shake random people's hands. But he's one of the most profound artists of all time, you know. And I think that was because, irregardless of what his limitations were, you know, mentally, emotionally, verbally, it didn't matter. He knew who he was, and he was exactly who he was. And I think although he was a lot different than his peers and the people around him, they respected him and allowed him to create, because they knew this is who he is, and he believes in who he is, and we have no choice but to accept that. And I feel like and I'm rambling, so if you have a question, cut me off. But I feel like we're now in a place in the world where, like, you know, there's so many things that are changing, and we can kind of go backwards a bit, like in terms of like where we are now with the fact that, you know, the majority of, you know, email responses I get, there are pronouns attached to it. That's not something that was relevant 5 years ago, or at least we didn't think it was, because a lot of us were ignorant to this, you know. So I think that, like, as we continue to propel forward and accept, like, these new habits and these new norms, it's the only way we're going to get to a place where we all feel safe and comfortable and content with where we are as a society, as a community, as a society, and just as a world. But, you know, things for so long have been so jumbled, and, you know, in terms of who can be successful in fashion, you know, where it was like for a long time, it was that person who went to fashion school, that person who worked under a high-end designer, and now they're coming out with their own line, where it's like now a big majority of these young fashion designers are people who just started making t-shirts in their parents' basement, you know, or were doing graffiti, you know, art on paper in their bedroom as a child, and now they're doing amazing things. And I think once we take off those limitations in terms of what this person is supposed to be doing, because for me, he's Black and he works in the outdoor industry, so he should blank, you know, it's all these stigmas. Mm-hmm. I probably should be living on the West Coast or in Utah or somewhere in Seattle where it's closer to climbing, and it makes sense. I should probably live in a van. I live in an apartment building in Yonkers, New York. Granted, we're super close to nature, but like, I'm still a city kid at heart and we still live in the city, but that shouldn't change who you perceive me to be or how I'm accepted in the industry. I feel like once we get to a better place of accepting those things, we'll be in a better place.
I really hope that people are listening to this, and not only your story and the specific circumstances around your story, but applying it to their own lives, right? This idea of bringing yourself into everything that you do. I mean, there's so much here that I just wanted to add this right now to anyone listening, and just bringing your own perspective into this, because there was a lot in there that you just said. I'm actually going to have to recap it in the replay. I'm starting to wrap it up here, but you know that you have this incredible message and story to amplify to the world, but I'm not sure, this is not a very well-formed question, but I don't think I've had any well-formed questions so far in this interview.
You have, you're doing great.
But a lot of people approach their own path with, oh, I have to get this out in the world. I want to do this. I want to spread this message. You are just focused on, this is what I'm going to do next. I don't know what's going to happen with it, but we're going to make this film. Now we're going to work on this film. And now I'm doing this project. And without necessarily an idea, although you have an end goal. And I just wanted to hear a couple minutes how you approach each step.
Gotcha. How I approach each step. I think a lot of it comes from me just, I write a lot. I spend a lot. Yes. I spend a lot of,
that's what I tell people.
Yes. That's something new for me for the last couple of years. You know, I found myself, especially on climbing/camping trips at night, I tend to not be able to sleep very easily. So I've gotten into a really good routine consistently for a while now of doing at least 10 minutes of stretching and about 10 minutes of breathing exercises before I go to sleep, but then also writing. And a lot of my writing, it's in a weird way, it's like I feel like I've held off for a very long time. So a lot of what I write isn't just from my experiences in the now, it's from my past experiences and things that have been on my mind for a very long time, and just getting them onto paper for me makes it a bit more real. You know, sketching things out is another step. And then there's a ton of different steps that I take depending upon the project, whether it's with product or like for the film, it was really just storyboarding a lot of it. And just, I'm not an artist, but like just sketching and writing out scenes and kind of thinking how these would play out and how it would make sense. Because we all watch TV, we've all seen a ton of movies and shows, and you see how these stories play out. And for me, when I was writing the short story, it was always just a short story because it was in my head. It wasn't me writing this because I want to create a film. It was me writing this because I'm sick of it being so deep in my brain. I need to get it down on paper. Maybe I can understand a bit more as to what this really means. And so I think it honestly just goes back to the organicness of it, you know, the seamless way that I kind of put myself in a position to make it make sense for me, especially if it's something I want. You know, like I said, I didn't go into it saying, I'm going to make a film and I'm going to be a director. Absolutely not. It was more of me thinking, okay, cool. This is something that makes sense to me. I need to get it down. You know what? I'm going to share this with some friends. And that led to one thing, and one thing led to another. And I had an amazing team of, you know, 6 to 7 professional filmmakers that worked with me on this film and gave it their all for 2 days straight. And I'm forever grateful for that. So honestly, it's just it's the writing. It's really taking those steps that make sense for you, because that's another thing too, because everyone's process, as I mentioned a ton of times, is not the same at all. So if you can figure out without forcing it what your process needs to be like for you to find comfort within being uncomfortable, and I think that is the goal. That should be the goal for an individual trying to figure out what that next step is, because there's no real formula. No one's ever done this one time over, you know, and came back from death and said, okay, cool, you guys are doing it wrong. This is the way to do it. If you want to be creative, or if you want to make music, you have to know how to play these 10 instruments. No, there's tons of artists who are very successful that have never played an instrument in their life. That data was broken. And I feel like if we can look at life the same way and understand that, like, there's really no right or wrong way to do this, as long as you do this wholeheartedly and you're true to yourself and those around you, and, you know, you keep that gratitude close to you and you keep pushing forward, like, you can't do wrong.
I love it. Why the name Elephant Gown?
Oh, so that's a deep one. So the Elephant Gown, it's a play on the elephant in the room, and obviously the racial topics that, you know, we've talked around for a very long time. And, you know, obviously things have happened, but we're still living in a world where, you know, young Black and brown people are still being killed, you know, senseless acts of crimes, and it makes no sense. So that's where that name comes from. But then from young TJ's perspective, when his grandmother's trying to keep him away or out of harm's way, his perspective of what she's telling him is in the form of a boogeyman. So it's actually a horror film, a horror short. And the boogeyman is this person wearing an actual gown that has elephants on it. But this person represents all those traumas. So every time you see this person appear, it's to appear to show a new trauma, essentially.
Okay, so where can people find you, and how can they stay in touch so that we know when Elephant Gown comes out and all these other things that you're working on?
Absolutely. I mean, Instagram is probably the easiest. You know, it's just my name, at Ra Robinson, RaHRobinson. Or my email, myfirstname.lastname@gmail.com. Super easy to get to me. With the Elephant Gown, there's some info on my page that kind of connects you to the Elephant Gown page, in which we're going to be doing a private screening in the next 2 weeks for as many people that want to see it before we take the festival route. But I'll definitely send you a link to it so you can check it out as well.
Okay, cool. And we'll include that in the notes. Awesome. We could go all day. It feels unfair to have to end it right now. Can you pronounce your name for me so I can not make any assumptions?
Sure, yeah. Raheem Robinson.
Which is what I would have assumed, cool. But I always do that.
No worries.
Thank you. Did I leave anything out that I should have asked?
No, I think we hit it on the nose. I mean, for me, with these talks, it's always nice to be able to give the listeners my story from front to back, because fortunately enough for me, like, my beginning has to do with my now to a degree, and so on, and all,
right.
And everything is kind of intertwined, from, you know, the work at the DA's office to the film, to, you know, the dreams I had as a kid that essentially are what made the film, you know, or my start in fashion, how I took the things I learned there and applied them to the outdoor industry, you know, from a fashion perspective, but with a love for the outdoors at the same time. So thank you for allowing me to tell my entire story.
I loved it. I mean, it's really amazing. I have one particular person in mind right now. I just had a conversation with someone. She's 35 years old and just feels so lost. And it's just really interesting that I had that conversation yesterday and I'm talking to you, and, you know, she's turning to me for advice, and I'm trying to think, well, what can I tell her to do? And it really made me, I thought, you know what, it's not that you have to do something, it's just that you're asking yourself the wrong questions, where she feels like she has to have this life mapped out. And honestly, it's just like, what are you going to do next? And how, you know, everything you have, she has this varied background, she has so much potential, and it's just a matter of not knowing right now that you have a story, not knowing right now that you have a plan. But when you look back on it, just like you're looking back on it, and you have all these things came together, and it seems like it was by design, but it wasn't by design. It just happens. So
yeah, it's strange, but I'm super grateful. And the one thing I will leave you with is, you know, the idea of chasing an unrealistic life, or what you think your life is supposed to be, is unrealistic. Chase joy. Joy will always slow down for you, and you're in control of that. Find your joy, and you'll find peace in that. And you don't need anything else, and everything else will just be icing on top.
Thank you for joining in and hope you're enjoying the newly relaunched Breaking Trail podcast. I'll link up to all the resources and contact info in the show notes at breakingtrailpod.com. That's also where you can get in touch with me for comments, questions, and guest suggestions. Hey, if you have been enjoying this podcast, I hope you will subscribe, share, and review wherever you listen to your podcast. Those reviews and shares are so important to getting this show out to more and more people like you. And one last thing, if you or your team need some guidance in using story to make change happen, contact me to learn more about coaching and training programs. Let's schedule some time to discuss. Lisa at breakingtrailpod.com, and I will see you in 2 weeks.